Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Thanks for joining us on the Ethics Experts. You're at FedEx right now.
Right.
So tell us what you've been going through right now.
Well, just like everyone else in the country, this caught everyone off guard. So it's a matter of now just trying to figure out how can we help make a difference. And so everywhere we can, whether it's small businesses or working with the federal government to get supplies, wherever, it's how can we help move things forward?
Yeah, it's been a crazy, I can't believe how long it's been. It's like, I mean, has it been a month now?
It's actually been a month.
It's nuts. Yeah, some people, I remember when it first popped off, some guys were like, oh, this will be fine. It'll be like 2 weeks. It'll be like a little snowstorm. Seems silly now. You know what I'm saying? Everyone's got a beard. No one's gotten a haircut in months.
Right. Look, fortunately, I cut my own hair.
Look at you. You took that out of the equation. That's smart. Yeah.
So I'm going to set up a shop in my backyard with gloves and mask and just start.
Put it on the end of a stick and you can keep your social distancing.
That's it.
So listen, man, I've been real excited to get you on. The whole point of this podcast is to talk to kind of thought leaders in the ethics and the HR space. These people in these positions that, from my mind, are totally underutilized in most companies. They're viewed as cost centers. They're viewed as they get pigeonholed. They're the folks whose budgets get cut first. When in my mind, they're the folks who can really unleash the organization and can affect the culture and unleash the gifts that are embedded within the workforce, who are the greatest assets of every organization, particularly at this phase of our economy. So I found you on LinkedIn. I started reading your book, which I love. I'd love to spend some time talking about that. Maybe we can just jump in. Why don't you kind of start telling us a little bit of your story? Don't give away the book, because I think it should be kind of required reading for a lot of folks who want to kind of get inspired and know what's possible. But how did you get into this whole game?
Yeah, so I actually born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. Two blue collar parents, both grew up, working 2-3 jobs, helping make ends meet. In high school, this was a kind of transitional moment. I grew up an A student kid, but in high school, I made C's, and I always wondered, why no one ever asked me why I was a C student or what happened?
Right.
I always kind of say the A students, get patted on the head, congratulations. The F student get told you can do better, and the C is kind of like, you did your best.
Yeah, you are whatever you're going to be, okay? Yeah. You're there.
Good luck to you. You did your best. But it was one day in high school that I had a work permit because I was working 2 jobs and I was getting ready to leave. The guidance counselor stopped me and she said, hey, Chris, before you head to work, I want you to listen to this presentation. And it was a nonprofit by the name of En-ROADS, whose mission was to identify and develop young, talented minority leaders for corporate America in the future. And so I listened to the presentation. First thing they put up, minimum requirement, GPA 3.0. I got up and I walked out. All right, I'm headed to work. But that individual from En-ROADS walked outside and said, hey, let me talk to you. And got to understand my story. And he said, I tell you what, we're going to make an exception, let you into the program. And I asked, who's going to pay for this? And he said, well, we have companies that sponsor students. If you'll intern with them when you go to college, my sponsoring company was FedEx. And FedEx granted me an internship while I was in college through that program En-ROADS.
How crazy. I mean, imagine. So, I mean, that's just so nuts, right? Because you're still there now. How many years has it been? It's been a while.
21 years now.
Amazing. 1 year. So, I mean, there's so much packed into that first little seed of the story. What do you think it was that made that guidance counselor tell you about this program?
Well, the guidance counselor knew that work was most important to me, but she also recognized that, I was a 17-year-old kid. It's like, so you really hadn't had a chance to experience life. Well, let me point you here. And I always go back and say, it took the guidance counselor, the nonprofit, and corporate America, a company like FedEx, to all work as vital links in the chain that made me successful. And so today we're trying, I try and work to build those same linkage, because corporate America probably won't walk the school, the halls of high schools, but if they can, we can partner with nonprofits who can partner with the guidance counselors, we reach more kids such as myself.
And FedEx is obviously a great company. You've seen a ton of transition there since you've been there. But that heart that they had to even have this program opened seems to be something that's resonated with you throughout your tenure there.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's the reason I am, you know, everything I do today is all about helping people reach their full potential. It was the reason why it made me write a book about it, because I go all the way back to the trajectory that that moment set for my life. And then all of the people that were in my life as a result after that, that gave me nuggets of wisdom.
So let's dive into your time at FedEx. So you're you know, about to go into college, or you get into college and you start with your internship there. From that point to where you are now, that's like, you know, that's kind of Flintstones to Jetsons, as my friend says, right? Like, you were on the ground floor. Now you're kind of up over a lot of different things. Talk to us about what that path was like and what some of those challenges you met.
Oh yeah. So interesting enough, I started in IT. So the majority of my career was actually rising through the ranks in IT. And then there was a moment probably about 4 years ago when I said, you know what? I want to align my purpose, passion, and profession. And that was when I shifted to HR, which, you know, is quite the, many people would go, IT people don't shift to HR.
Right. But, so IT people hate people.
Yeah. And I was known as a techie. So, you know, who's the techie going to HR? But I, you know, kind of that journey from IT intern to VP of HR, early on, that was a moment. And I started my career pretty cocky. You know, I came out, you know, just like every 20-year-old, I know everything and prove I don't.
Right.
So I walked into our director of IT's job at the time, and I heard they made good money. And job looked easy enough. You know, I'm 20 years old out of college, and I'm looking at him, that job don't look hard. And so he had a door policy. He said, hey, come see me anytime. So I walked in. He said, young man, how can I help you? I said, I want your job. Tell me how to get it. Well, he commenced to chew me out left and right.
Great first impression.
Yeah. Telling me, it's like, you don't know the first thing about leadership. And he was right. I said, well, I tell you what, I'm going to come back every month until you teach me what I need to know. And for the next 10 years, that individual mentored me. Every month we met.
So I kind of, there's a lot in that even, right?
Yeah.
What made you kind of grab that bull by the horns? I mean, look, I'm all for mentorship. My whole career has been built on mentorships, but I don't feel like I had to sort of wrestle a guy into a mentorship. It sounds like you forced this guy to be your mentor, which, you know, good for you.
Yeah. Well, it was, for me, I've always had this, once I see it, I will work my butt off. Like I tell people even to this day, I'm not the smartest guy in the room. You know, I was a C student and I worked hard for those. So, but I will continue to push. And there was one question that I would always ask of anyone that was in the job I wanted to be in. I would say, if you could go back and be me, what would you do differently? And every executive I talked to and asked that question, if you could go back, what would you do differently? All of them gave me nuggets of wisdom to go, you know, yeah, I got to director at this point, but these are the, you know, things I screwed up. This is where I went wrong. And that's when I love this quote, you know, experience is the best teacher, then learn from someone else's experience. And so that was me. And so By 27, I was a manager. By 32, I was a director, and I became a vice president at 39.
Wow. So that's a fast track, obviously, right? Like, that's, you're probably at each of those levels, kind of the youngest guy in the room at some level.
Exactly.
How much, and this is maybe a stupid question, get ready. I'm going to be firing dumb ones at you the rest of our time together. how much of that success, though, could you attribute to that desire or that sort of humility that you brought to those conversations to ask for that advice?
Definitely, it's the trigger in the beginning. Like, the willingness to take the hard feedback and become better. And I've coached many people over the years that get stuck right there. And it's easy to blame other people. Mm-hmm. But the reality is they struggle with taking that initial feedback. Like when he told me, you don't know anything about leadership. I mean, I could have taken right at that moment and go, well, he just don't want to help me. But instead I go, you know what? I'll take that. Then teach me.
And how does that mentality or lack thereof contribute to this glass ceiling effect that you talk about in your book?
Yeah. And so I talk about the fact that many times we're creating a glass ceiling for ourselves and don't realize it. You can see the opportunity, but you can't reach it. And you think it's somebody else holding you down. And that's why I like to unpack thinking drives behavior, and behavior, your ultimate results. So let's get to the root of your thinking. And if your thinking is somebody else is holding me back, you're actually holding yourself back.
Yeah. And you could maybe even look at it, you know, one other layer lower, that there's some feelings behind those thoughts. So if you can't get over that sort of ego death that needs to occur in order to take that feedback as the gift that it's meant to be, then you're always going to be trapped in this sort of glass box that, to your point, we're kind of creating for ourselves.
Right. And while you're in that box, I mean, it's amazing how the mind will continue to feed itself those narratives. And I had to start unpacking for myself. Some of that thinking came from people I trusted the most.
Tell me some more about that.
Sure. My parents and different mentors and friends of mine would always say, well, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Well, I got to a point where I sat at the table with, you know, a Fred Smith and his executive team. And I can assure you of one thing, what you know is much more important at that C-suite table than who you know. Because once you get to that table, you're solving some of the world's problems.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think if who you know is the most important, then that's almost a defeatist attitude, because unless you come from money, or unless you're rubbing elbows at, you know, the private school or at the country club with, you know, those who know who they're supposed to know, then how do you ever get there, right? You're always on the other side of the chasm. Whereas if it's what you know, and it then turns into a merit game. It turns into a game of, well, I can educate myself, or I can put myself in positions to learn the lessons I need to equip myself with a toolbox that I then can bring to the job site to build the house that I'm trying to build.
You got it. I change those words, and because I challenge the first part of it, it's not what you know. And I ask people, when has that ever been true in your life? So shift it. Who needs what you know? And so just that shift in thinking goes, right. Well, first, I got to think through an inventory. What is it that I know? And then you start your networking. I tell people now, you're networking too soon. You're going around networking events, handing out your business cards, shaking your hands, and wonder why no one calls you back. That's because you brought nothing of value to the table.
Huge point.
Yeah, but when you start thinking, who needs what I know? Now your networking is intentional.
Right.
Now coming to offer something of value to help you, and you take something of value to anyone and they're going to reach back.
Yeah. And you know what? If one of them doesn't, the next one will. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just that it's that reciprocity thing that's embedded in the fabric of who we are as human beings.
Yeah. And that was when that whole C4 framework started to really come alive for me. You know, that first step of consuming information and consuming the right information.
Let's frame out the C4, because I really love the framework. I've really learned a lot. You know, I've learned a lot from you in the last, you know, 15 or 20 minutes. The book is phenomenal. I'm almost done with it. But let's kind of, for listeners who haven't read it yet, let's kind of frame that out, because I think there's a lot of insights that you pack into that game.
Yeah. So that first C, and I tell everyone, this is where you start. It starts with consuming the right information. I mean, right now, especially in this whole COVID-19 situation, it's information overload coming at you. I mean, from the news, from social media, I mean, everyone's got an opinion, and it invokes a lot of feelings. So you've got to be intentional about what information you actually consume and take in, because it starts to affect your thinking.
Right.
And so now, once you've consumed the right information, now start to connect the dots. And this is where businesses can now shift from surviving to thriving. How can you now take what you've consumed and connect the dots with someone else's need?
So you've talked a lot about intentionality.
Yes.
You come across, obviously, as somebody who's very insightful and probably somebody who's very introspective. You spend time, it seems, in your head, kind of analyzing the data points that you're bringing, that you're, you know, encountered or that you encounter. For somebody, so in that, I guess what I'm getting at, in that is a sort of a captain of a ship who's looking at the stars and looking at the wind and so forth, and who's adjusting the rudder or adjusting their sails to go to where they're trying to go.
Yep.
I think a lot of people go through life, they're a captain of a ship and they don't know it. The sails aren't even up. The rudder's not even in the water. What can we do for someone like that to kind of give them some actionable things to say, okay, look how the wind's moving across the waves, or look how the horizon looks, or look how the clouds look tonight. There's a storm coming tomorrow. How can we start empowering folks who maybe don't have the intentionality you have or the introspective nature that you have to start elevating themselves?
Yeah, I tell people often, career.
Buy my book. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. No.
Buy the book. But I often say, a career and life is like a GPS. The journey doesn't start until you set the destination. And most people fail simply because they haven't decided where to succeed. I my wife and I, every day, 5 o'clock, like clockwork, phone call rings, ba-ding. What's for dinner? Well, what do you want to eat? Well, it don't matter. What do you want to eat? And we go back for probably 10, 15 minutes. And I remember one time we're in the car and we're driving. I'm driving. I was like, what do you want to eat? You want to eat Mexican? No, I don't want to eat Mexican. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, then what do you want to eat? Well, you pick. And then I pick another restaurant. No, I had that yesterday for lunch. So one time I just pulled the car over because I was frustrated. I'm driving. I'm passing these restaurants. We don't know where we're going. I don't recommend that with your spouse, by the way. Just saying.
Yeah, good advice.
We're frustrated, and I said, hey, let's just pick a restaurant, and if we get there and don't like it, we'll pick another one. I often tell people a career in life is just like that. When you're driving every day, getting up, going to the same job, and it's unfulfilled, and it doesn't feel like you're making progress, but you're unsure of where you want to be, pick a destination.
I couldn't agree with that more. I remember when I was in college, there were a lot of guys that I knew who they were kind of undecided. Their majors were undecided and they don't know what they want. And I think we get this idea that, well, if I find the perfect field, then it's not going to feel like work. Like, it's always called work, regardless of what you're doing. Okay. So you can find something that you can put some passion into and so forth, but I agree. I think 80% of it is, you know, what do they say? 80% is just showing up. 80% of your success is just picking something that you can run at, because you're going to have those challenges with anything that you do.
Exactly. You're going to face the challenge, but it's now getting up with a purpose. I know where I'm going. And if I get off course, just like a GPS, it'll course correct. It'll reroute. And then that's the key. You know when to reroute, because you're off course.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of people maybe go through this life kind of playing checkers when they should be playing chess. And the reason I use that analogy is because in chess, you have to think about not just your next move, but the move after that. And yes. So what that can end up creating is, like, if you're aiming a gun, there's two sights that you have to line up. It's not just your first move, which is your first sight. It's that other sight at the end of the barrel that you need to sort of line up in order to hit your target. And if we're just always focused on that next move and not the move after that, to your point, which is the destination in your example, in your mm-hmm. GPS example, then you end up kind of wandering, or you end up kind of, you know, not hitting any target.
Yep. Yep. And you're chasing the immediate gratification. It'd be immediate, like, this next job should be fulfilling my life's purpose. Well, but where do you want to be 5 years from now?
Right.
And I often tell people, once you set that destination, so if you're going from your house to the office, does it really matter if you turn left or right outside of your driveway? The GPS will reroute you to get there if you make the wrong first turn.
Good point.
There are critical turns once you get closer to the destination. But to your point, people will stress over that first turn.
Right.
Not the one you should spend the energy thinking about.
My dad would say, if you wait for all the lights going into town to turn green before you get off the porch, you'll never leave.
There you go.
You got to get moving.
You got to get moving. You got to get moving.
And I think having that to your point, that destination thinking embedded into your career plan or your personal plan or whatever, allows you to better handle the difficulties on those interim steps. Because again, it's never easy, right?
Never easy.
But if you're focused just on, hey, this next job should be phenomenal and that should feed me in the figurative sense, and you hit those rough patches, then you start questioning and saying, well, this is not how this is supposed to feel.
Exactly.
But if this job is a lily pad that you're just stopping through to the next thing, or this experience is a lesson point for you to build toward the person that you're trying to be, it becomes a lot easier to deal with those long nights you got to work, or those difficult bosses that you have to, you know, work with and so forth. I mean, I'm sure you've had a lot of that through your path.
Oh yeah. And so, and once you set the destination, now the people around you can help you because they know where to step in once you hit those hurdles and roadblocks.
Yeah. And that's a great point. That kind of mirrors what you're saying about the networking piece. If you know what you need, or if you know what you have, you can market in a sort of a value first way. If you know where you're going and you can then identify what you don't have, you can ask for the mentorship for the specific things. And that's an actionable thing that a mentor can bring to the table for you.
And that's when a mentoring actually starts to take shape and grow. I mean, I've established many mentoring programs over the years, and I'm actually not a fan of formal mentoring programs.
Why?
I think it has to mature as a genuine relationship. But I go back to my first mentor out of En-ROADS. He challenged me and made me decide a goal 10 years into the future. He said, what are you going to?
What have you seen, or where have you seen sort of the formal mentorships fall flat?
Multiple companies. I mean, I've advised multiple companies, and even, you know, within a FedEx, we've tried it. Where it falls is the first conversation, you know, once you kind of orchestrate the mentor and mentee, first conversation's good. The second conversation, it goes, okay, both parties are looking for something different. And usually by the third conversation, it fizzles out. Because it's not a genuine, authentic relationship. The mentor wants to help, but they don't know how.
Yeah, they don't know how to help. And sometimes the mentee just knows, hey, I need a mentor, but they maybe haven't done that work that you're talking about to say, hey, I really need help with this aspect of my game.
Yes. And that's why I tell someone that's with those aspirations, you got to think of your career like a GPS. You can't put in restaurant in the GPS and get to a specific location. You have to be specific which restaurant, which job, in which career, and be okay with picking one that when you get there, you don't like it.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world if you pull into the parking lot of the Mexican restaurant and you say, you know what, I want Italian.
Exactly. But
you're already out. You're already out there, and you've, you know, part of the game is just kind of cutting away pieces of the world to say, okay, it's not this, it's not that. And then it ends up being the thing that you want.
And like I said, then people can reach out and help you and go, oh, it's an Italian restaurant just a mile up the road.
Right. Perfect.
And now getting specific guidance.
Remember that analogy you had in the book about the hand reaching?
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me about that, because that's really stuck with me since I read it.
Sure. So that first mentor from En-ROADS, when he made me sit down and think 10 years into the future and write down the goal, first thing I said was, I'm going to be the CEO. And, you know, I'm 18 years old. I didn't even know what a CEO was, but it sounded cool because I heard it on TV. And he said, oh, you want to be the CEO? And he turned around. He made me look at a picture on the wall. The title of that painting is He Ain't Heavy by Gilbert Young. He Ain't Heavy. And it's an arm reaching down from a cliff and a hand reaching up. And he made me study that picture. And it was like, what do you see? I said, well, I see a hand reaching down, someone reaching up. Obviously, someone needs help. He said, nope, you missed it. I said, I know I made season in high school, but that's a hand reaching down and someone reaching up. And I said, I get it as a leader. You know, you got to reach down and pull people up. He said, no. He said, as a leader, you got to always be both hands. One hand's always got to be reaching up for additional knowledge, for wisdom, because you'll never know everything. And one hand has to be always reaching down to pull people along and pull people up with you. And what I realized as I started to grow in the leadership and move in the middle management and then to the executive level, when you've got both arms stretched like that, your core is exposed. And that's when servant leadership starts to show up, because you start taking the shots from people as you are helping others and reaching for help. And that's the part where you can now start to shatter that ceiling, when you're willing to expose your core to pull somebody else up, but continue reaching up because you realize you don't know it all.
We can write a whole book on just this thing, okay? There's a lot in there, right? That that servant leadership can really, servant leadership in my mind kind of is slated on a foundation of vulnerability. And that picture that you just painted with your stomach exposed or in that prone position is really a very vulnerable position. And there's a lot of humility in it and a lot of vulnerability in that, when you can expose that type of vulnerability, I guess, to your team as they see you reaching up and to ask for help. What I think it can do, though, is it can build a lot of authenticity, because they're like, wow, this guy's reaching down to help me, but he's also reaching up to get help. And now I have permission to reach up and get the help that I need. It turns into a cycle, you know?
Battle you cast as a leader. And I had to learn that one the hard way. You know, I talk about in the book, my first interview at director, where I hit that ceiling from manager to director. And I went into that first interview. Oh, it was funny. I can look back at it and laugh now, but I had to give a 10-minute presentation on the vision, the strategy. And this was back some years ago when everyone was telling you, you know, enunciate your words, don't say, you know, all of those, you know, things that make communicating effective. So I practiced in the mirror, perfect enunciation. And when he kicked off the interview, it's like, all right, go at your presentation. I said, well, my vision for the organization is this, and the four strategies are this. And I actually talked like this because I felt like this is how directors talk.
Yeah.
And I like this.
You're conveying a lot of authority there.
authority. And I laugh because I go, I sounded like President Obama before there was a President Obama.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I thought I had done well.
You thought you crushed it.
I thought I crushed it. And, you know, the feedback I got from that interview was like, what the hell was that? And who the hell was that guy?
Because they could see that was not you.
That was not me. And the panel didn't know me as well. And this is when I started realizing that don't underestimate the intelligence of people. They can spot a fake. And so, and that's when, oh, wait a minute, this thing about vulnerable and exposing your core. No, I got to show you all of me, including the parts that I'm, you know, not excited, my weaknesses and what, where my failures are and where I'm, what I'm afraid of. I got to reveal it all. And that's tough until you get past that ceiling. And I, that's why I call it, that's another one of those glass ceilings that people struggle with is, you know, it's easy to tell somebody how great you are. Tell me where you suck at.
Right.
Expose yourself so that I know where to help you. And I think that really helps people shatter through that ceiling in their life.
Yeah, it is an important, it's an important sort of comfortability with our own skin that we have to get, right? You have to be kind of comfortable with who you are to some degree and confident in your skills, and also recognize that, hey, some of these things I'm probably not going to be able to change, and that's okay.
Yep.
How do we get to that point faster?
Yeah. And so this is where that whole C4 framework for me, and that's why I feel like it's a repeatable framework. Once you've set that destination, now you get into the mode where you're consuming the information about that, because what you know is important. And so now you got to consume the right information so that you've got a foundation of knowledge and insight to be able to share. Then you start to connect the dots so that you can serve and help others and go, how does this information help solve your problem? The third C becomes critical. And I think it gets, you know, kind of glossed over, but it's the ability to communicate.
And you're saying to just drop your voice and just enunciate all your words.
No.
I'm kidding.
Opposite. No, it's the ability to tell a story. People remember stories. What they don't remember is vision and mission statements. And I've written a lot of vision and mission statements in my career. And no one ever remembers those. But when you can relay a story that helps people understand what we're after right now, people galvanize around the story. I often tell people, tell me about your favorite movie, and they'll recall that movie like they just watched it last night.
And why is that? What is that thing?
Because movies and stories evoke a feeling and an emotion. And I often say, I'm trying to remember who I got this quote from, but people might not always remember what you said, but they'll never forget how you made them feel.
Right.
Maya Angelou.
Yep.
And so the story needs to invoke a feeling for them to remember. And if you can connect the feeling to the mission, now they get it and they go after it. I mean, it's why right now at FedEx, we've got 400,000 team members out here trying to help save lives. We don't feel like we're delivering packages right now. We feel like we're connecting people with possibilities. And you do that through the stories you tell so that people can realize how it connects to them. And that's that art of communication I'm talking about in C4.
Yeah. Organizations seem to really fall short on that. And why do you think that is? I mean, it's very apparent. We all spend our weekends watching movies. We all tell stories to our friends, but when we want to tell stories to the marketplace or to our employees or to our team members or whatever, it just feels so flat. What is that?
I think we forget the enjoyment of the story ourselves. Like when I was sharing about, you know, that moment that that mentor made me look at that picture, He Ain't Heavy, I was reliving it again. And those are the stories, and we all have them. It's just taking the time to step back and go through kind of my own inventory of, man, what are the stories that meant something to me that connect to what you are trying to achieve? And let me tell you about that. And the funny part is we do it at a restaurant all day long.
Right.
Somebody's going through something and you go, I remember when this happened, and you start to tell them the story. We need to do that as leaders in the workplace every day.
Yeah, and maybe it's this thing of the lowest common denominator thing, or, hey, I got to tell a story as an organization that's going to appeal to everybody. And if it appeals to everybody, it appeals to nobody. But if you can get more specific and get more visceral and get more sort of, if you can niche out the story and talk about your own experience, it's weird how that ends up resonating with people more, because they really are grabbing on to those emotional handles that are coming out of those stories.
Right. And that's why I said, they don't always remember what you said, but it evokes an emotion and a feeling that drives a response.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they may just go, I want to learn more about what you were talking about. That's so, what you're.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this transition, because, you know, you're kind of an atypical IT guy, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm talking in stereotypes here. You're not like, you know, you're a great storyteller. You get this sort of human angle. You get this emotional angle. What is it that made you want to sort of propel out of IT into this HR field? And how have your sort of complimentary and maybe surprising gifts allowed you to accelerate your career in this HR game?
Yeah. So I tell people often, I chose IT as a career when I was 18. The 18-year-old me was very different than the 28-year-old me. And the 28-year-old me became different than the 38. I'm going to step in the house. I think I got someone cutting grass next door.
It's an essential service. You know, you can't cut your hair, but you can cut your grass.
That's it. But yeah, so the 18-year-old, the 28-year-old me became much different. And so I started to realize there were things that were important to me at, you know, as I got into my 30s, and I hit that, it's like, it's time for me to try and line up purpose, passion, and profession. Not that I didn't enjoy IT anymore, but I was more passionate about helping people reach their full potential. And where it started for me is I started joining nonprofit boards and volunteering at the church and everywhere I could. And I mean, it got to a point where I was mentoring people at my house on the weekends. And finally, a friend at work who was in HR bumped into him in the cafeteria, and he said, "Man, I think somewhere in your life you zigged when you were supposed to zag. I think you're supposed to be in HR." And I initially rejected the idea. I was like, "Nah, man, I'm an IT guy." And I think there's another area where we put that glass ceiling on ourselves. We label ourselves something, and I labeled myself an IT guy when other people could see something different in me.
Isn't that interesting? Those labels we put on ourselves are just, they can be walls to these glass prisons that we find ourselves in. It's crazy.
Yeah. And that's when I started to go, all right, I got to break through this ceiling and take this risk, because one of my mentors was our chief information officer. So think about that as a dynamic. I'm a director in IT with, you know, continued career aspirations. My mentor is the chief information officer, but I'm switching to HR. Who does that?
Yeah, what was that like?
That was a tough, tough decision, because it was a pull in my heart, but, you know, all of the data said I should stay in IT. And there were people that would go, "Are you crazy? IT people don't go to HR." And there's much more of a career growth on the IT side. And I finally had to just say, this is something that's in me. I gotta go do it, or else I'm gonna regret not knowing.
Isn't that interesting? It was first presented to you and you're like, "No, I'm this guy." And then during some kind of a metamorphosis process, you start to consider it, and then you start to really see this is actually really resonating with me, to the point where you're willing to sort of, at some level, again, this is maybe dramatic, but like, bet your career on it.
Yeah.
Bet all the goodwill and equity that you've built over in this IT organization, and all the networking that you've done. I mean, the chief information officer is your mentor. That's a very highly coveted mentorship, right? Within that very powerful pillar of a, you know, world-class organization.
Yeah. Well, and the book that I read that really helped me anchor in and trust in it was actually Purpose Driven Life by Rick Warren.
Mm.
And those questions at the end of each day, and that, you know, because it's set up for 40 days, started to go, what are those things that you would do for free that somebody else is willing to pay for?
Like that, that's where your purpose resides. And what are other people telling you about you that you're struggling to accept?
Yeah, isn't that crazy how we just really don't know ourselves as well as we think we do?
Yeah, yeah. And if you think about it, this fast-paced life we live, who takes the time? You actually have to intentionally stop, be alone, uninterrupted, and learn who you are. Consume information about yourself.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's hard to do. It's hard to carve that time out because we're pulled in so many different directions. Mm-hmm. Putting out fires, responding to emails, hitting the, you know, the notifications on our phone and stuff like that. As you swung over into this new organization within your company, what were some of your initial challenges, first of all? What were some of the accelerant points that your sort of unique perspective brought to the table? And what were some of the things that you were like, you guys are doing what?
Yeah.
Like, what are some of the realities of it that you were just like, whoa, what is this?
Well, you know, first thing, having an IT background, now switching over. Now, I moved over from a director in IT to a director as driving our workforce strategy. And I remember the first thing that was like, oh, wow. I was in conversations and the term IOs kept coming up. Now in IT, an IO is input output. And I kept hearing the term the IOs. So, you know, I went to a peer colleague of mine who long relationship. I shut the door. I say, hey man, I'm curious about the continuous dialogue about inputs and outputs in HR. Needless to say, that is not what they were talking about. It was actually industrial psychologist. And I had to go, okay, what's an industrial psychologist? He said, yeah, it's those people that work for you now. I was like, oh, okay. Let me go back to the first C and start consuming information so I can ground myself in understanding, but also understand where I can connect dots, but listen to the information I don't have. Back to the point, I now got to reach up to the people that work for me because I don't know their space, but I can help them connect dots. And so the area where I started helping was from the technology side and how we recruit STEM talent. And that became a niche for me because it was a problem we were struggling with, just like every other company in the country. The STEM shortage was affecting us all. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I can help solve that.
And what sort of thinking did you feel like, you know, it's like when you get a new house and you move into the house, and, you know, and you move in and you're like, oh, wait, this pipe knocks in the wall, or, you know, it's never as perfect as, you know, it looks in the brochure. There's always some of that when you get involved with a new company or with a new position. And what were some of those things that really surprised you as you made that move into HR?
It was definitely in the hiring space. And so the belief was, well, you have to just throw more recruiters at it. And well, we need more recruiters in order to hire more people. And we had several challenges that we were looking at. So this was roughly 4 years ago. That was when the unemployment rate started to really drop. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking at the data going, man, unemployment rate is going to go well below full employment. And so this, we're going to end up in what I call a war for talent across the country. And so, and you can't throw bodies at that. And so now here's the opportunity to leverage innovation and technology. And so I actually reached out to Google and through my relationships from my past life in IT and said, hey, you guys want to work together and solve this problem? And what we came up with and realized that in the blue collar space, because we needed like 40,000 package handlers for our peak season volumes. And we go, how am I going to hire 40,000 package handlers in 12 weeks with no increase in recruiters? So reached out to Google. We started working together to see what does the search patterns look like? And it became real clear that the type of person that would work in our sort systems as a package handler would search for the job warehouse. Well, none of our jobs were called warehouse. And so that was one of the reasons we were losing in the candidates. So we worked together, and we're working together, and came up with an algorithm that matched location and search pattern to what the individual that's searching would actually go do. And that actually became Google for Jobs.
Wow. And
yeah, so Google for Jobs launched, I think it was 2017. That was the work of us partnering together. And that's now one of their platforms for everyone to use.
Kind of a game changer on both sides of the fence. Like, talk about a win-win, huh?
Exactly. And then we went a step further, and like one of the other areas we were challenged with, and it's our heart and want to do, is hiring military. And so, you know, you go to a military recruiting event, the individual from the military walks up and says, hey, I'm a, you know, 26 alpha X rank, and states his job title and everything in the military. And the recruiter looks and go, huh? And then the military person go, well, what type of jobs you have? And they go, well, I have a software developer, 3 coding in this and doing this. And the military professional goes, huh?
You speak different languages. Yeah.
2 different languages, but we know they're qualified. And so it's like, hey, all right, Google, let's work together. Here are all of my jobs. Can you pull all of the MOS data, the military occupation codes, and let's do a translation? So now if you go to the FedEx career site and just type in 26 alpha, it automatically tells you all the jobs that person qualified for.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really powerful.
Yeah. So, you know, Google launched that. It's embedded in our career site. And now we're helping connect people with possibilities in that space.
So let's talk about this thing. We spent a lot of time. I really love your analogy about the GPS and setting that destination. And I want to talk a little bit about reconciling that whole thing with the reward being the journey itself.
Yeah. You know, that revelation came to me when I actually, so I had set the goal to be a director. Remember when I told you I walked in my director's office and said, I wanted your job? Mm-hmm. I actually ended up getting his job 10 years later. I know.
Well, yeah.
Actually got his office and everything because he had moved to another job. Here's what, this was interesting what happened that year. So I had spent 10 years working toward that goal. You know, extra hours, get the master's degree, had kids, all of that good stuff. And the year I got that goal, it was 2010, that Christmas, my wife and I decided that we were not going to spend a lot of money on gifts. Matter of fact, we're going to do the, you can't spend more than 10 bucks on a gift, because we wanted it to have meaning. So I said, all right, I created a video. And it was a video highlighting everything that had happened to us that year. And so my daughter had graduated kindergarten. So it was video clips from the graduation. We had went on a vacation to the beach. So we're playing. I got different music. I'm jumping in, kind of narrating. I mean, it was great. At the end, I rewatched the video. Guess what never made the video? The promotion to director.
Amazing.
And that was when I stepped back and said, wait a minute, I spent 10 years of my life, you know, preparing and aiming for this moment. This is the year I achieve it. And it didn't make the most important thing that happened to me that year.
What does that tell you?
And that was when I stepped back and said, ah, you still got to know how to enjoy the journey. The journey is actually the reward. And then there's that whole balance of understanding why you're doing what you're doing and who is it for. And that's when I try to always keep in context, it's about my 2 kids and my daughter. And if I have to push them aside to hit it, then wait a minute, I'm out of balance.
Totally.
And
it's a really insightful point. It's like you need a destination to go on the journey. But the thing is not the destination, because when you get there, all the magic happened on the journey.
Exactly. You know, that epiphany in life. It's like, wait a minute, this ain't the reward, the getting here wasn't as exciting as I thought.
I don't know. You probably play the same game with yourself. You ever drive traveling in the car and it's like, I'm going to beat my time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm supposed to get there in 6 hours. I'm going to get there in 5.5.
Right. It's that same thing.
So how much of that journey did you miss? Because you were so focused on getting there in 6 hours, in 5.5 versus enjoying it in 6.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think if you're too focused on that destination, you can start to your point, lose sight of the magic that's happening along the way. And then you're perpetually living in this state of wanting, or this state of essentially scarcity, to use, you know, to kind of borrow that term, because whatever you're going through is not enough. It's not satiating you because I'm not at that destination yet. But then again, when you get to that destination, I mean, it's like when a guy wins the heavyweight, you know, boxing belt, and then he's like, well, now what?
Now what? Now what? And that's why that final C, that fourth C, is so important to me. And that's now coaching other people forward.
Right.
So what am I doing throughout the entire path to my destination? I'm helping somebody else. And there's where you're getting the enjoyment at every step. The highs and the lows.
Right.
Whenever you're trying to do it alone, you will, I can assure you, when you even reach that destination, it's an empty feeling.
So as we wrap up, I'd love to kind of ask this question of folks. Well, I'm going to ask you two. The first one is going to be, if you knew now what you know, if you knew then what you know now, what would be different in your life, you think?
I would have given myself permission to have patience. There was periods where I wanted it so bad that I early on looked past other people. I had both of my hands reaching up instead of one hand down and one hand up. And even when I got to the goal, that first goal, which for mine was becoming a manager, it was an empty feeling because I was alone. I had both hands reaching up. So that's the one thing. If I knew then what I know now, I would say, slow down. You had things to give even in your 20s that you could have helped a high school kid, and you did not do it.
Yeah, that's the opener. We all have that stuff, right?
Yep.
Even if you're a young person working with people who are of a generation or two beyond you, there's stuff you can help them out with technology, or there's stuff you can help them out with communication and things like that are maybe more tacit skills that aren't as sort of deeply embedded in the organization, but can make a world of difference for that individual.
Absolutely. And here's what I realized. You're sharpening your own skills when you help someone.
Good point.
So
that leads to my next question. So, you know, your organization is a pretty sort of forward-thinking company. Mm-hmm. It's an organization that at least externally conveys an understanding that its greatest assets are not the planes and the trucks and the sorting machines. It's actually the people. And I think that resonates with you. And I think you kind of exude that both through this conversation, just other things that I've read and, you know, seen about you. That's not sort of common across most organizations. Most organizations don't recognize the impact that HR can have on the strategic pursuit of that organization. Like I said at the start of our conversation, it's many times viewed as a cost center. So I always like to talk about what we can do to help elevate this position. What advice can you give somebody who's in this type of a role in sort of one of these backward thinking organizations that's so dollar focused, dollar myopic, that they, you know, humans are labor units in the company, not its greatest asset. What would you tell them to do to help elevate the position and turn those light bulbs on at the top, so to speak?
I tell all HR leaders, lean into the business you're in. I actually don't describe myself as an HR professional. I tell people I ship packages. And it's shifting your mindset to thinking like a shareholder of the company. What do the shareholders care about? And I'm going to consume information around that and then connect the dots to the people and the culture. And then I'm going to now communicate that back in story form so you understand how this employee connected to that mission and how this employee did this to deliver on that And now I'm going to coach them with that methodology.
Yeah. How powerful is that, man? That is a great one, right? So I'm going to think like a shareholder. I'm going to consume information from a shareholder perspective. I'm going to be able to then speak that shareholder language to the boss who's profit. He's obviously getting comped or whatever by profit. He's comped by the things that the shareholders care about. So you're going to be able to speak that language, and then you're going to be able to intertwine all these stories that are going to hit that emotional response with that decision maker, that controller of those purse strings, for them to see like, oh my gosh, I have a, you know, I got a hill full of oil here I need to start drilling into.
There you go. I wake up every morning. This is one of my habits. And the first thing I turn on TV is CNBC Squawk Box every morning. And when you come in my office during the day, CNBC and the stock ticker is what's on. And I've had leaders all the time. It's like, why is an HR guy watching the markets? I said, because our business affects the markets.
Right. We're in the markets.
We're in the markets. So if I don't understand what's going on in the market, I can never connect the dots to the value HR brings to the company.
Yeah. Why is the batting coach spending so much time watching the game?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been a great conversation, man. I appreciate you being so authentic and putting so much of yourself into this book. I'm really learning a lot from it. I appreciate you coming on the Ethics Experts today. What is your parting gift of knowledge or wisdom that you'll leave us with today?
Sure. You know, in these uncertain times, you have a choice. The fear can make you bitter or better. I say choose better.
I love that. I love that, man. I'm going to, don't be surprised if you start seeing me use that like everywhere.
Hey, there you go. Go take it. Just tell people to buy the book once you share it with them.
I will. The book is C4. The genius behind it is Chris Winton. And thank you so much, my man.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.